Welcome to the Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Joanne, and I will be reading today from The Summer Club by Hannah McKinnon, and this will be episode 4. Darcy watched in disbelief as Spencer bent down to her level. His lips moved, but she could not make out his words, and then, after one long pause, the two of them waded into the lake up to Ellie's knees. Moments later, Ellie was splashing around with Spencer. Other kids came to join. They shrieked and laughed, and before the other lifeguard blew the whistle for swim time to be over, Ellie Watson was soaked head to toe. She had not even tried to swim, but she was smiling. Spencer strode out of the water and slicked his wet hair back with a Greek, like a Greek god. Then he flashed Darcy a thumbs up. "What did you say to her?" she mouthed. "Tell you later," he mouthed back. Darcy felt herself melting in the sand. Later, Spencer was going to Reagan Rogers' house party. That meant she and Lily had to go, too, if it was the last thing they did. "Girls, it's getting late," her mother called upstairs. "Didn't you say your movie started at 9:30? Going to the movies was a firm. No way her parents would let Darcy go to the party without a million questions and rules. "Yeah," Darcy lied, hurrying downstairs with Lily on her tail. "We're leaving now. Don't want to miss the previews." "What time does the movie end?" Her mother put the kettle on. That was Ingrid, making tea when she could be making a martini on a weekend night. Darcy would be so different when she was 50.
Around 11:30.
"You don't have to wait up. We'll come straight home and be super quiet coming in." She was ready for Ingrid to object. But to her surprise, Mother handed her a Ziploc bag of cookies. "Sneak them into the movies in your purse." Ingrid had been on the phone all day with her client from Boston, who might be making an offer on the stupid treehouse. When her mother got stressed out, she baked. Darcy was not about to risk her progress by stuffing her face, but at least the cookies had distracted her mother from sticking her nose in their plans. "So cute," Lily teased when they were safely in the car.
"Your mom made your favorite cookies,"
Darcy groaned. "First of all, those are Adam's favorite, not mine." She buckled herself in and checked her hair in the visor mirror. "Second of all, it's suffocating and needy." Lily shrugged. "At least she gave you something nice." Darcy turned to her best friend.
"Didn't your mom recently give you a box of condoms?"
"Yeah, and in the same breath, she told me not to use them. What kind of messed up message is that?"
"At least she knows you're not 7.
So far, they've done a drive-by past Regan's house twice. There are only a few cars parked in the driveway, none of them which they recognized. "It's not crowded yet. If we go in there, it's not like we can blend into the crowd," Darcy worried aloud. Lily checked her lip gloss in the mirror. "I wasn't made to blend in. I say we go."
"Fine."
They were just about to get out of the car when a navy blue BMW blew past them and swung into the driveway.
"For real?" Lily said, yanking her door closed just in time.
Darcy craned her neck to see who it was. Spencer Delancey slid out of the car carrying what looked to be a six-pack of beer. His friend Blaine and two others joined them.
"Looks like the party started," Lily said. "Let's go."
The door had been left ajar, but Darcy hesitated. "We weren't exactly invited."
"No one's going to notice," Lily said, pushing past her. She was right. The foyer was packed with people from school, holding solo cups and talking in clusters. Music blared through the living room. Darcy spied Spencer and his friends by the keg, but Regan was working the tap.
"What if he asks us to leave?" Darcy whispered. Instead, when they got to the front of the line, Regan asked, "One or two?"
"Two," Lily said. Darcy threw her a look. They agreed that Lily was designated driver. Relax, Lily whispered. It's just one. We'll be here a while. Just as Regan handed them their beers, someone cut roughly in front of them. It was Ashley Riley in a short pink dress that left nothing to the imagination. Uh-oh, party's just started and she's already blitzed, blatted. Ashley shrieked with laughter as though this was the funniest thing she ever heard before stumbling backward right into Darcy. Look out, Lily warned, but it was too late. Darcy's beer sloshed up over the rim of her solo cup, soaking her arm and spraying the front of her denim shorts. It looked like she peed her pants. Ashley, look what you did. It was Spencer, spinning Ashley around by his shoulders to see, so she could see the mess. Oops, sorry, Ashley didn't look sorry with that fake smile on her fake tanned face. I didn't notice you there. Spencer stepped in. I'm really sorry. She had a feel. It's not your job to apologize, Lily said. She glared past him at Ashley. It's okay, Darcy said, swiping at the bear stains with her hands. But it wasn't okay. On top of being told she was basically invisible, now she smelled like a keg. Don't move, Spencer said. He trotted off toward the kitchen and returned with a handful of napkins. Ashley's usually a lot of fun, he said. Then, sometimes too much. She should work on that, Lily said, grabbing a napkin and dabbing at Darcy's shorts. Thanks, Darcy told them both. Spencer was being so nice, just like at the beach. Hey, that was pretty impressive today with Ellie Watson. That camper of yours who hates camp? I've been trying all week to get her in the lake. What did you say to her? Luckily, she doesn't feel the same way about ice cream as she does about swimming. I told her that the ice cream truck was coming, but it was only for kids who went in the water. You lied to the little girl at summer camp? Her voice came out much flirtier than she intended. The last thing she wanted was to sound like vapid Ashley. But Spencer was grinning back at her, and she basked in the glow. God, he had so many perfect white teeth. Technically, the ice cream truck is coming, he said. It just doesn't come until next Friday at the end of the first session. Technically, there's no swimming requirement for a cone, she added. Spencer laughed. Personally, I think Ellie looks like a kid who likes a lemon Italian ice. She's got to keep that sourpuss going. That's not very camp counselor-like. Spencer was funny. And maybe he was flirting just a little bit, too. Was that even possible? Hey, let me relieve you of that and get you a fresh one. He gestured toward her solo cup. Oh, no, it's fine. Then let me get you the next one. Darcy's breath caught. Okay, that would be great. Hey, Delancey, it was Spencer's friend Eric shouting across the room. You gotta see this. Regan is racing Ashley with the funnel. Spencer winced. Great. He lifted his cup. Cheers. It was good talking to you, Birch. Darcy raised her cup to his. You too, Delancey. He barely left the room before Lily was in her face. He likes you. No, he doesn't. He just felt bad. He rescued your shorts. Lily lifted her cup to Darcy's. See, I told you, Darce, this is our summer, and it's just the beginning. After that, Darcy's first beer turned into a second. Spencer did not deliver as promised, but she didn't mind. What she did mind was that Lily was also having another. What are you doing, driver? Lily shrugged. I'm only sipping, and the party's good. We're staying a while, right? Darcy didn't love the fact Lily wasn't keeping to her word, but she let it go. The night was fun. They would be there a while. They popped into the kitchen to watch the funnel races. When Lily's favorite Taylor Swift song came on, they joined a small group of girls dancing in the living room. When it got too hot, they stepped out to the deck. Darcy leaned against the porch railing, letting the bear settle into her limbs. Overhead, the sky was dark, the stars popping. For the first time in a long time, she felt lighter. I have the best buzz, she said proudly. I'm jealous. I want to join you. You already have, Darcy reminded her. I know, but I could have more if we stayed over. Darcy sobered a little. Coming to the party was one thing. Crashing there was another. My parents would freak out. Fine. And you really can't drive anymore, Darcy said, studying her friend. Maybe she should have driven. Unless we stay, Lily raised her eyebrows. We could tell your mom we're going back to my house. Darcy glanced around uncomfortably. Where would we sleep? It's not like we're tight with Regan or anyone else here, really. Look like you were getting a little cozy with Spencer Delancey. Darcy knew what Lily was really doing, coaxing her along to get her away. But she also felt bad for her best friend. I don't know. I guess maybe we could stay over. Lily's eyes popped. Really? It was hard to say no to Lily. Darcy shrugged. Fine. Go, Darce. I love you, I love you, I love you. Lily squeezed her hard, then let go just as fast. I'm getting a drink. Be right back. So they were staying. Darcy took a swig of her beer and looked around, wondering if Spencer was staying too. And just like he appeared in the doorway, when he saw her, his face fell. Damn, I never got you that beer. I can get my own, thanks. This got his attention. He joined her at the railing and their shoulders brushed. All right, I like an independent woman. Woman? No one ever called her that before. Unable to meet his eyes, Darcy looked down at her almost empty cup, then at his. Looks like you need a refill too. Let me. Before he could reply, she took his cup from his hand. It was bold for her, and for once she was genuinely feeling it. She found Lily in the kitchen, waiting for Regan to finish mixing some frothy concoction in a blender. Yellow foam was pouring out of the lid. Both Regan and Lily found this hilariously funny. What is that? Fun juice, Regan said, gleefully holding up the pitcher. We tried to make pina coladas, but I didn't have any rum or pineapple juice, he made a face. So we mixed gin and bananas and 7-Up. Want some? I'm good, she leaned into Lily. Maybe skip that concoction. Okay, Mom. Darcy stood in line again for the keg, feeling pleased to be carrying Spencer's cup along with her own. Double-fisting, Lily asked, joining her. Darcy noticed she was holding the cup of Regan's nasty concoction. One is for Spencer. Lily narrowed her eyes. You are getting cozy. Relax, we're just talking. Come join us. Back outside with two fresh beers, Darcy tried to listen as Spencer told them about his father's new boat on Mayhaven Lake, but she couldn't stop staring at his long eyelashes. She wondered if he got his blue eyes from his mother or father. She wondered if they had kids, if their eyes would be green like hers or blue. It didn't matter that she was distracted. She'd already heard the boat story. Apparently, Mr. Delancey had purchased a racing boat with an engine too big and too loud for lake regulations. When her father reminded him of this, Mr. Delancey bypassed him and used his clout on the board to launch the boat from the club dock. Now, there were all kinds of problems with the lake authority threatening to take the club's boat slips away. He decided Spencer must not know about what his father had done. Maybe you guys can come out on the boat sometime, Spencer said. It was a casual statement, more than an invitation. But Lily took him literally. When? She asked, tipping back the last of her fun juice. Maybe, Darcy interjected coolly. Make no mistake, she would be on that boat if Spencer was serious, even if it killed her poor father. She was just imagining herself roaring across the lake next to Spencer when Ashley Riley stumbled out onto the deck. She looked around, her drunken gaze landing hard on them. There you are, she wobbled up to Spencer and threw her arms around his neck. Darcy couldn't help but notice that despite being trashed, not one hair was out of place or an eyelash smudged. Here I am, Spencer said, catching his balance. Whoa, looks like you're having a good night. Even better now that you're here. Ashley gazed up at him like they were all alone, and Darcy's stomach sank. She could already feel the cloak of invisibility falling over her. I'm grabbing another, Darcy said, turning quickly to Lily. Her beer was full, but she had to get out of there. Thankfully, Lily led the way. Wait, little girl. It was Ashley calling after them. What did she just call us? Lily halted and spun around. Darcy knew the look on her best friend's face. Ignore her, she implored. She's drunk. Not you, Ashley called to Lily. I'm talking to your little friend. The deck went quiet, and Darcy could feel everyone staring. She could go inside and pretend she hadn't heard, but it was too late. Everyone else had. Ashley, one arm still slung around Spencer's neck, was staring right at us. "Sorry, I don't know your name, little girl, but grab me a beer?" "Excuse me?" It took everything in Darcy's voice to keep it from shaking. "I said, grab me a beer?" Ashley snorted. "Jesus, is she deaf?" Someone laughed. Darcy's heart thudded in her ears. Spencer took the cup from Ashley's hand. "I'll get it." He didn't correct Ashley and offer up Darcy's name. He didn't offer to get Darcy one, too. Instead, he ducked his head like he had no idea who she was and slipped by her in the doorway. The scent of his cologne filled her nose. "Lily, I need to get out of here," she whispered, but Lily had other ideas. "What is your problem?" Darcy could feel her friend leaning toward Ashley, ready to close the space on the deck between them. Lily was fierce. Darcy had had enough. "Let's go," she tugged Lily's hand, whisking her back inside through the crowd. They bumped into people in her haste. "Ow, slow down," Lily cried. But Darcy could not slow down. She threw open the front door and pulled them both over the threshold and outside. "Darcy!" Lily huffed, struggling to keep pace. But Darcy was halfway down the steps and across the driveway before she let go of Lily's wrist and burst into tears. "Hey, come here," Lily tried to pull her into a hug, but Darcy held out her hand. "Why did she call me that? What the hell have I ever done to Ashley Riley?" "I don't know, Darcy, because she's a bitch. Because she saw you talking to Spencer, and she's jealous." Darcy hated that she was crying. She hated that they were stuck in Regan Rogers' driveway, her clothes reeking of warm beer. Most of all, she hated that she allowed herself to believe that someone like Spencer Delancey would be interested in someone like her. "They're all drunk," Lily reassured her. "No one will remember." "I will," Darcy cried. "Little girl." It was worse than being sworn at. More than being called a bitch or a whore or a slut, the usual names they all threw around at each other. Because the truth was, that was exactly how Darcy felt among that crowd. "I know you want to get out of here, but I don't think either one of us should drive yet," Lily said softly. It was vinegar in a bleeding cut. "Let's get in my car, we'll listen to Taylor and wait it out." Numb, Darcy followed Lily to the car. They rolled down the street a bit, away from Regan's house, and in any view of the party, and parked in the cul-de-sac. Lily rolled down the windows, and cruel summer spilled from the speakers. "Here," Lily said. She reached into the back seat and handed Darcy the bag of cookies. Darcy didn't know what was sadder, sitting in the car hostage to this hellish night, or the fact that the taste of her mother's chocolate chip cookies made her wish that she really was a little girl again. Next chapter, Flick. You're at the snack shop for the morning shift, Mosimino informed him the next morning. Flick rubbed his eyes. His mother and Stan's party had gone late. Afterward, come straight back up to the club. I need you here for the dinner party. It was the first golf scramble of the season, and the club was abuzz. Flick had no idea what a scramble was, another silly country club word that meant nothing to him. What he did know was that the lobster boil that night was a big deal, and he was looking forward to getting some big deal tips. "And I'm working the snack bar alone?" Flick shifted from one foot to the other. He never worked the snack bar shack before. Mosimo twisted one edge of his mustache. "Yes, but don't worry. No bleu de blanc down there. Just burgers and hot dogs. It's what the people want." He made a face of mild offense, then quickly recovered. "Ricky will bring you down and set you up. You can handle a grill." It wasn't a question. Flick's small Queens apartment hadn't even had an outdoor area where they could use a grill, but he had learned to use the gigantic Weber Stan had purchased for the new house's outdoor kitchen. In fact, he had done most of the grilling just last night at his mother and Stan's first neighborhood party. Since they moved in, hosted a party so they could introduce themselves to the neighborhood was all Josie had talked about. As soon as Josie picked a date, Flick's inside had flip-flops. So Darcy Burt's would be coming over to swim in his pool and eat steak and hang out, hopefully in a bikini? No, it turned out she would not. They were setting up for the party when Flick had asked, armed with a gold candelabra centerpiece in one hand and pointing with the other. Josie was directing Flick and Stan on how to arrange the outdoor furniture. So, my boss and his family will be here tonight, Flick tried to sound casual. The last thing he needed was for his mother to get into his business about a girl. The Birches aren't coming, Stan said quickly. They aren't? Apparently, this was news to Josie. They're our closest neighbors, and I haven't even met them yet. Did they say why? Sam shrugged. I didn't invite them. What? Josie did not look happy. He's too uptight. From the first night he came over with that plant, I could tell he was antisocial. Flick opened his mouth to disagree, but from the stubborn look on Stan's face, Flick knew better than to argue. Besides, he knew his mother would be all over this. Fitting into the new neighborhood had become an obsession for her. He came over with the plant? When? She set the gold candelabra down on the table with a thunk and stared powerfully up from all of her 4'11" height to his 6'4" frame. Stan had actually leaned back. Didn't I tell you about that? No, Josie pressed her lips together. Well, what happened, Stan? Flick almost felt bad for the guy, shifting like he was from one foot to the other. Birch was whining about our gorgeous new RV, said I couldn't park it in our yard or something, some nonsense. Can you believe the nerve? She narrowed her eyes. It's a big vehicle, Stan. Stan threw up his hands. So it's on our property. Do you want me to park it in front of our garage doors, block our driveway? This is not good. They're our neighbors, she rubbed her brow, and he's Flick's new boss. Don't worry, sweet thing. In a couple of weeks, we're taking the RV up to Maine. After that, I'll see if I can figure something out. Josie looked relieved. And you tell the Birches that? As soon as I see them, Stan promised. Which you will when you invite them to the party, Josie said. Since it's too late to send one by mail, you should pop over in person. Ha! Stan wasn't going to do Ned any favors with the RV, nor would he likely pop over and extend the last-minute invite. That would only reflect badly on him. And that was exactly what happened, because the party went on and the Birches didn't show. Still hopeful, Flick had changed into a burnt orange shirt that made his eyes pop, as his mother said, and worked the grill with a smile until it was clear Dossie and her family would not be coming. He eyed Stan, who, as usual, was talking too loud and too much. Around 10 o'clock, Flick had grown tired of the neighborhood crowd. How many times did he have to tell people how old he was and where he was going to school in the fall? And Stan's music had gone up to his room. Flick didn't like that Stan had lied to his mother, and he really didn't like that an opportunity to socialize with Darcy Birch had been blown. Darcy was pretty. Darcy seemed cool. Stan was ruining his opportunity to get to know her, and maybe even pissing off his boss. Something had to be done. Did the girl show? Mateo texted. Nope, thanks to Stan. No invite. He doesn't like them. What a douche cramping your style. Wait until your mother finds out. Yeah, I'm waiting. Waiting on the girl? Shut up. Maybe you'll see her at work. Maybe. Work your magic, Creevy. Girls like you. The girls here are different. There was a pause before Mateo replied. Then, don't sweat it, man. You'll find your people. Okay, Mom. F you. Thanks, man. I know. Now Flick hopped into the golf cart and followed Ricky down to the snack bar. You'll be fine, Ricky said. At least you get to avoid the scramble chaos. Flick was kind of hoping to be involved in the chaos. It sounded more interesting than sitting at the snack bar all day. It turned out the snack shack wasn't so bad. He got to be outside. There was a bunch of little kids and mothers on the beach, but there were a few hot teenage girls, too. Like Mossimo promised, the food was easy. Nachos, burgers, hot dogs. There were packaged ice creams in a small freezer and a bag of chips. He only ran into trouble when a college-aged girl asked him for Arnold Palmer. Excuse me? The thing was so ridiculous, he laughed. Luckily, so did the girl. It's a popular drink here, you know. Half lemonade and half iced tea. I did not know, Flick admitted sheepishly, but now I do. You'll have to look up who the heck Arnold was. The girl slid her sunglasses up on her head and grinned at Flick. She was pretty. I'm Iris. Extra ice, please. I'm Flick. Nice to meet you. Extra ice, Iris. when he handed Iris her Arnold Palmer. She took a long sip. Not bad. I'll be back later for a John Daly, she winked. Okay, now he needed to look that guy up, too. There was a burger and a dog rush around noon with a few impatient mums holding red-faced toddlers. An ice cream blitz followed. By then, the mothers were feet up on the lounge chairs, done with feeding, entertaining, and sunscreening their noisy charges. Instead, they doled out $20 bills to their kids and sent them flicks away for more ice cream. He was relieved at three when Ricky drove the golf cart back down to collect him. Survive? Barely. Ricky assessed the snack bar. Not bad, kid. The grill was scoured, the counter wiped down. He closed up the service window and locked the door, feeling pretty good about things. He was about to hop in the golf cart when Ricky pointed to the beach area. Forget something? Flick followed his gaze. All three garbage bins were overflowing. Paper plates and cups spilled into the grass. Sticky ice cream wrappers lay stuck in the sand. Flick groaned. By the time they emptied the bins and run the garbage back up to the stinking dumpster behind the clubhouse, a fleet of golf carts were already parked at the front. The exodus of players from the green spilled out onto the outdoor patio and milled about beneath the white tent. Buckle up, Ricky said. Snack Shack has nothing on a member dinner party. Flick eyed the crowd. Hoot swapped their golf attire for linen suits and dresses and their irons for icy cocktails. A jazz band was set up on a small stage beneath the tent, and music tinkled softly across the lawn in their direction. What lay before him was exactly what Mateo had teased him about, the white bread all-American summer dream. Flick was half-tempted to snap a photo and text his friend, but he was too embarrassed. From where he stood, he wasn't in on the joke. Now he was part of it. Upstairs, the kitchen was harder than Hades. Mossimo stood at the center island, pulling cuts of meat out of marinade bags and arranging them on trays while he shouted directions. Corn! I need the corn to get out of the grill! Where the hell is the corn? And who is on the steaks? These go out in five! Ricky was outside manning the boiling pots for the lobsters. Flick's eyes traveled to the refrigerator, which someone had left open. The shelves were lined with paper seafood bags, some moving. Behind you. Wendy swept up around him and grabbed two bags from the fridge. You working or watching? Without waiting for a reply, she began loading bags of lobsters into a plastic crate. Mossimo clapped his hands impatiently. Help her out! Help her out! Apparently, there would be no review of the kitchen schedule today. Flick jumped into action. When the crate was full, he ran into the pantry for another, and they filled that too. Come on, Junior, Wendy said, as she hauled crate up off the ground. We've got to get these guys down to Ricky. The crates were heavier than they looked, and Flick staggered down the back stairs behind Wendy. They handed the lobsters off to Ricky, who was beet red, standing over the pots. Wendy paused, wiping her brow with the back of her hand, looking around. Pretty different out here, huh? She nodded toward the white tent. Mayhem members mingled, selecting appetizers from trays as servers buzzed around them. Ice clinked against glasses. Laughter emanated from under the tent. Somewhere a cork popped. Not a bad scene, Flick allowed. Wendy squinted at the crowd. Not my thing. They're the honey and we're the bees. A microphone crackled on stage. The jazz band paused, and one of the golf pros stepped up to announce the winning foursome for the day. Raffle ticket numbers were called. A deliriously happy woman in a golf dress trotted off with a gift basket wrapped in gold. Let's just hope they get drunk enough they tip well. Wendy went back inside, leaving him to unpack lobsters. Flick understood he was new up here, but he couldn't conjure the same ire Wendy seemed to hold. It was a country club, but they knew that what they were getting into. On the other hand, there were people here Flick was generally coming to like, from Mr. Birch, who's worked his tail off but was always smiling, to the older men who liked to tell him stories, and crazy old Bitsy Babcock, who always asked how he was doing and offered him a bite of whatever dish she ordered in the dining room. Take a taste. No one's looking. Where before he would have made fun of these people. The more he worked there, the less easy it was to dismiss them out of hand. But, to Wendy's point, there was also the Spencer Delancey's, textbook country club cliché. Flick spotted a cluster of members around his age. The girls were in short dresses. He recognized a few as camp counselors. The guys wore polo shirts and belts with lobsters and whales, looking like their mothers had outfitted them. There among them was number one Spencer himself. Flick watched him throw his head back, laughing. Golden boy, Mateo would say. But then Flick's glaze landed on Ned Birch and his wife. Mr. Birch was dressed up in a sports coat, making the rounds and greeting people. Right behind him were Adam and Lett Darcy. Darcy wore a light pink dress. She looked bored. Beautiful, but entirely bored. Adam fidgeted next to her, and Flick watched her lean in and whisper something in his ear. Whatever it was, Adam smiled, and the fidgeting stopped. Flick wondered why Darcy wasn't with number one's group. Maybe her father wouldn't let her. Or, even better, maybe she didn't want to. A hand rested on his arm, and Flick turned. Mrs. Bitsy Babcock was gazing up at him. She put a hand to her forehead, her oversized ruby ring catching the sun. My, it's hot over here in Lobsterland. Would you be a dear and get a girl a refill? She held out a diminutive silver flask. Flick wasn't sure why she brought it over to him at the lobster boil, but he took it. Hendricks, please. None of the cheap stuff. Give me a powerful heavy. Why Bitsy was drinking from a flask at a dinner party where servers and fresh drinks were plentiful, he did not understand. Wouldn't you prefer I get you a glass with ice? Mrs. Babcock laughed. I would not. Flick glanced at the long line at the outdoor bar, then at Ricky, who shrugged. Be quick, was all he said. Bitsy put her hands together. Straight up. Lime twist, dear. Flick wasn't sure exactly what that meant, but the bartender knew. When Flick handed him the flask, he shook his head. Bitsy? Flick nodded. She was waiting right where he'd left her, looking impossibly sober for a tiny woman who just polished off a flask. How lovely. She unscrewed the cap and before taking a swig, held the bottle out to him. You look hot. Oh, no, thank you, ma'am. Bitsy frowned. Never call me that again, dear. Oh, I'm sorry, Flick stammered, the word ma'am almost popping out again. I didn't mean. She lifted her flask between them as if toasting. Gin is what keeps me so young. Neiman Shriver joined them. He surveyed the boiling pots. Cockroaches of the ocean. Excuse me, sir? Smelly, messy endeavor, this. Mr. Shrive was wearing a pinstripe blazer that was far more festive than the look on his face. What you need is a good steak. Flick gestured to the large chalkboard menu. We've got steaks on the menu. Mr. Shrive scowled. I can read. All right, then. Anything I can get you, Flick asked. He needed to go help Wendy or he'd be dead meat himself. Yeah, a steak. Old people like to eat early. Flick knew from this. From his grandma, back in Queens. They'll be right out, Flick promised. He was relieved when Wendy waved him over, despite knowing he'd get an earful. Hey, Junior, unless you brought your seersucker suit, I think you're wanted in the kitchen. Sorry. Back upstairs, the kitchen vibe had turned manic. Flick pictured all of Mr. Shrive's waiting for their steaks. Salad was aggressively tossed, dressed, and whisked out. Trays of corn, still steaming, sailed by. Steaks were hauled to the grill, where Ricky threw them on to flames. Flick found himself running up and down the stairs between both worlds. No sooner had dinner trays gone out than appetizer trays came in. The work never slowed, nor did the directives. Flick figured he basically ran for 2 hours straight until the dessert course. When the jazz band picked up outside, only then did the kitchen slow. Oven mitts were exchanged for kitchen gloves. Sleeves were rolled up and dirty parts lowered into soapy sinks as burners cooled on the range. Flick's forehead was a sheen of sweat, salt, and cooking oil. He couldn't remember when he'd last eaten. Outside, tiny strawberry cheesecakes were passed on silver plates. Good work, good work, Massimo chanted as dishes were scraped and glassware loaded into the steaming mouth of the industrial washer. As the crew finished up, Massimo disappeared to the upper deck with an old-fashioned wooden pipe. Flick had never seen the chef smoke. Maybe it was his reward. Veiled in darkness, Flick only knew he was there by the occasional flicker of orange and puff of a pipe smoke. Flick was exhausted. His Converse was filthy from spilled food, and his feet were sore. When the last of the stainless steel surfaces was wiped clean and the dishwasher empty, Wendy appeared. Toast? She held up a mostly full bottle of Vouer Clicquot, not letting this baby go to waste. Ricky brought out clean glasses. Mosimo came inside. After pouring for each, Wendy took a swig straight from the bottle. Flick took a swallow of his champagne, the crisp notes bubbling on his tongue. Damn, this is good. Everyone laughed. He was on his way home, slipping through the shadows beneath the deck when he recognized Mr. Birch's voice. You remember my daughter, Darcy, of course. Flick's head snapped. He didn't notice anything about the group of people at the edge of the patio except how long Darcy's legs were and that dress of hers and how hollow her smile. Like him, she wanted to go home. Just then, she turned his way. Flick stepped out of the shadows and raised a hand in greeting. She stared through him so long, Flick wasn't sure if she recognized him. And then something unbelievable happened. Darcy excused herself and came to stand in front of him. So, you're my new neighbor. She was so close, Flick was sure he could smell strawberries on her breath. He would bet his life on it. I am, he managed. Her eyes flickered. Let's steal a car and get out of here. New chapter, Ned. When he was 6 years old, his father woke him early one fall morning. At first, he thought something was wrong. For starters, his father never woke him up, not for church or school, and certainly not ever to take him somewhere on a weekend. His father paid homage to 1950 cents of fatherhood, despite the fact it was the 70s and other dads coached baseball and cooked dinner and drove their kids to school. Providing was his father's idea of parenting, and also, as Ned would later grow to realize, marriage. Ned's father did not attend games or rub his stomach when he was sick, or tuck him in with a story at night. So when he awoke to find his father towering over his bed in the pre-dawn hours one autumn Saturday, Ned's first thought was that something was terribly wrong. Get up, his father said in his gruff voice. I'm taking you to the course. Ned blinked, taking in the gray light playing at the edges of his window and the man standing by his bed. Wordlessly, he slipped from his warm covers and did as he was told. Ned dressed quickly, ignoring the rumble in his stomach, and wondered as he passed his parents' bedroom door if his mother knew anything about this. He'd half tempted to wake Willie, who snoozed quietly with his thumb still in his mouth, but it appeared Willie was not invited. Downstairs, his father was already at the door. Come on, then. 15 minutes later, they pulled the car into the empty parking lot at Mayhaven. An older man named Lenny met them at the locked front door of the clubhouse and let them in. Morning, Art. Thanks for this, Len. Len was older and grayer than Ned's father and walked with a stoop, but his gaze was warm when it landed on Ned. No trouble at all. You two enjoyed the morning. Then, as now, Ned walked down the main hall, past the glittering display of trophies and old photos, though it seemed bigger and longer, its contents more mysterious. Len invited them into the pro shop, where he pulled a small golf bag from behind the large wooden counter. These may be a little big for him, he said to Ned's father, sizing Ned up through milky eyes. He'll adjust, his father replied. Then to Ned, who was looking around the shop with large eyes, well, say thank you to the man and get your clubs. The clubs, he would later learn, were left behind by a young member that summer, never claimed, and saved behind the counter by Len. Ned hoisted the strap over his narrow shoulders and hurried out after his father. Ned had never heard of Len before. He would later learn that they were old school friends, and as a favor on Saturday mornings before the club opened, he would let his father, Art, in to play as many holes as he could before the club opened and the staff showed up. Ned knew his father golfed on weekend mornings, but it never occurred to him where or how, or that you had to be a member to play, which Art Birch was not. Mayhaven was not a place his father could ever have afforded belonging to, but belong he did, striding across the fairway as a mist rose and haunting threads about them. As daylight broke over the horizon, Ned had his first lesson. The thing you want to remember, his father said, speaking to him for the first time like an adult, is that you can't force your swing. Ned did not know what his father meant then, but on the other such mornings that followed, he would come too. Those Saturdays would become his routine each season until the day his father eventually left. The strongest man with the biggest frame can be outdriven by a wisp of a teenage boy. Here his father looked at him, his eyes twinkling. It's never been a game of muscle. It's about grace. Grace was a word Ned would never have ascribed to the testy man who slammed cabinet doors and stomped in and out of their home, invariably wary of what was for dinner, just as he was with his wife, and Ned often felt his children. There was no evidence of grace in their home, in his aloof nature and constant whiffs of disapproval. But that morning on the golf course, it was a word he used to describe a game he was introducing his son to, the first and only real thing he had ever shared with Ned, and Ned grasped onto it like one does hope. On the course, his father was a different animal, a less threatening animal who cracked smiles and occasionally an odd joke, especially when he played well. His instructions for Ned were spare and simple, and thankfully Ned was a natural who took direction and understood how his body moved through space. His little brother, Wiley, sadly did not. Willie, when he was older, would be brought to the course only twice and not ever again. Over the years, it became something Ned harbored deep and lasting guilt about, spending time with a father who only existed on the golf course, a man Willie would never get to know. But after a lifetime of being sized up and found lacking, Ned clutched the small sense of worth he attained on those outings. It was his only source of nourishment from a father who, until then, had starved them all. The game of golf was not easy, nor were those early lessons enjoyable. His father was a devotee of rote practice. He began with the techniques of the swing, the art of setting up, the science of the club head striking the ball at its equator, the undeniable ping of a good contact when the small white sphere careened through space. Ned was as determined to learn the game as he was to gain his father's praise. Weekdays, he practiced against a net in the backyard, holding in his breath until Saturday when his father would take him out again. It wasn't long before he became decent and later excellent. "Your father is good to you out there," his mother once asked wearily. She was washing dishes the night Ned and his father had returned from a junior golf tournament three towns away, toting a trophy. Ned had plunked the trophy on the dinner table for Willie and his mother to admire as they ate. As usual, his father had taken the plate to his study where he dined alone, the faint notes of classical music trickling under the closed door. "Yes," he replied. "I bogeyed the first hole, but made birdie on three. I won by 2 strokes. Ned was talking about his win, not his father, because that was what had come to matter, but his mother did not seem appropriately enthused. Ned could see that he was speaking a language she was not versed in. His father had left her out, just as he had Willie, and suddenly Ned felt sorry for her. "That's good," she said, finally, returning her attention to the sink. They were interrupted by a sudden crash behind them, and his mother startled. When Ned spun around, he saw his trophy on the kitchen floor. It had toppled from the table. Willie stood beside it, eyes wide with fear. "You idiot!" Ned cried, shoving Willie out of the way. It was harder than he intended. Willie fell backward, banging his head on the floor. A wail of crying erupted. Before Ned could scoop up his trophy and inspect it for damage, his mother beat him to it. She snatched it up with one hand and his arm with the other, something she'd never done before. "Don't you treat your mother like your brother like that," she hissed, tears springing to her eyes. She held the trophy aloft between them. "This does not make you better." There was a sound in the doorway, and they all looked up to see his father. He surveyed the scene in front of them. A bitter laugh escaped him before he walked away. While Ned's mother turned to soothe Willie, Ned scooped up his trophy and ran upstairs to his room, righteous in his win. What followed was a surge of guilt he would spend the rest of the night pushing away from the corners of his sleep. That memory still plagued him, more than a memory of his father leaving a few months later. By then, Ned had come to realize that things were not so black and white and his father's golden light he basked in for so brief time was complicated. Ned's feelings for golf, however, were not. It was a sport he loved, despite the frustration. One day, you might play your best round, and the very next, you could blow up every hole. It was elusive and agonizing and wonderful, just as he found life to be. Out there, against the mountain views and sweeping breeze, Ned was reminded of his small place in the world, hopeful and humbled. There was no making sense of the unadulterated glory felt in one shot and the despair in the next. It was, he supposed, akin to a relationship he had with his father. Ned's father was an ardent golfer who never belonged to a club, a talented player who could not afford the membership dues and was not affiliated with a need to belong. As much as Ned emulated his father's game, he would never model his father's role in their sad little family. The day he married Ingrid, Ned vowed to treat his wife with compassion and respect in equal measure. Should they be blessed with children, he would hold those children. He would tend to hurt feelings and scrape knees alike. He would show up to school plays and cheer loudest at the dance recitals and games. He would be the best father he'd never seen shown how to be. When Darcy was old enough to toddle behind him at the club, he bought her a child's set of clubs so small they looked cartoonish. She loved them. In good weather, they practiced in the backyard. In winter, they practiced in the garage against the net. When Darcy got older, he brought her to the course and taught her everything he could. Later, when she outgrew his expertise along with the child's clubs, he signed her up for lessons. It wasn't just the joy of the game. It was the joy of sharing something he loved with his daughter. It was the jokes between holes, the high fives after she crushed the ball, and the sympathetic looks when she shanked it. Being out on the course taught him so much about his daughter and what she was made of. It was a privilege to witness her sense of cool on the course, her consistency, her focus. Darcy possessed what his father had talked about, grace in every sense of the word. For a few years, it seemed Darcy Birch lived for the game and was destined for greatness, which is why Ned was mystified when she up and announced she was quitting. None of them saw it coming. That season, she'd been at the top of her game. Trophies lined her bedroom shelves. Scouts began to show up. When she appeared in the living room and announced that she was done, Ned had thought she was joking. "What do you mean you're done?" he laughed. The previous fall, Darcy had won the qualifying round of the Massachusetts Girls Junior Amateur Championship. That spring, they were headed to Braintree for the tournament. Darcy had just come home from a simulator lesson with Vince. She had to be kidding. "I'm not kidding," she said, arms crossed. Ingrid followed her upstairs to her room, where they remained behind the door for 15 unbearable minutes, talking in hushed tones. She met Ned in the hallway. "She's quitting," Ingrid said. "But why? Did something happen?" Sure, their daughter was just as prone to irrational teenage moments as any other kid her age, and he and Ingrid had spent their fair share of time walking in on proverbial eggshells. But those moments were reserved for friendship woes or boys or failing an algebra test. Sometimes for her exasperation with her own family, but never golf. Golf was the one sacred thing that buoyed her through all of it. "She says she's burned out," was all Ingrid could say. "I don't understand it either, Ned, but I have to say, I believe her." "So what? We give up? We let her just quit?" Ned was trying to keep his voice low and failing. He allowed his wife to pull him down the hall and into the privacy of their own room. "No, but we do give her time. This is her decision, Ned. It's her sport." Ingrid was looking at him like she felt sorry for him. He didn't like it. "Remember, it's not about us." He knew this, of course, and yet he could not help but feel a sense of failing that he'd been so caught off guard. How long had Darcy felt this way? Had he misread his own daughter so badly? If that was true, what else had he misread? The thought filled him with panic. "I need to talk to her. Not yet, Ingrid said. Let's wait until later tonight, okay? She worried about upsetting you more than anything, it seems. Me? But why? Ingrid leveled him with a knowing look. Okay, fine. I get it. I'm wrapped up in this, no doubt. As her golf partner and in my line of work, I get all that. But as her dad, this is different. If she says she's burned out, how did we not see the signs? He sank onto the bed, feeling as if all the bones in his body had just melted. Ingrid sat beside him. She looked as confused as he felt, but notably not as hurt. I don't know, she said. Teens can have sweeping emotions. She's competed a lot this season, and let's be honest, the pressure at this level is high. She has a brain tree coming up. A scout is coming to watch her. Ingrid shrugged. Give her time. Maybe this will all blow over. But it did not. Now, with a new season of golf sparkling before them, Darcy showed no signs of returning to the sport. It left Ned bereft. He missed driving up to the course early in the mornings before work with his daughter. He missed walking the course as the mist rose above them, just the two of them. Most of all, he missed his daughter. The orbit she seemed to be on these days did not involve him, or her mother, or even very much her brother, it seemed. Darcy's young adult life seemed to be in a universe of its own, with parties and friends in high school comprising the strange new axis on which her planet spun. Ned knew this was normal. He knew that he should celebrate her independent spirit, but he could not help but feel that he had fallen from a sky that once shared, and her planet was revolving steadily into a dark season, its face turned away from the sun. New chapter, Darcy. So you grew up with the country club parties and preppy collars. Flick's tone gave no clue. It could have been awe or criticism. In reply, Darcy took a swig from the Pinot Noir, which she saw stolen off the table. Then she passed it across the cart seat to him. She liked white wine better than red, but thieves couldn't be choosers, pretty much. You golf? Once upon a time, but I quit this year. It was something her father still hadn't stopped asking about, and she could tell it broke his heart. The truth was, it broke hers a little, too. The night air was growing cool, and the party at the club was winding down. Being back out here on the course in a stolen cart felt strange. Even in the dark, she knew the rise and fall of the fairway. I saw your name on a gold plaque in the trophy case, Flick admitted. It was on a few, actually. Yeah, well, those days are over now. She could feel Flick's eyes on her. What changed? Darcy looked back against the cart seat. I guess I did. It was the troop. What happened had changed her. She didn't let herself think about the fact that her favorite hole was only 20 yards away, or that she could make her birdie on it with her eyes closed. She numbed herself to that part of her, the old Darcy. Now she was just a girl sitting in a cart with a cute boy who'd snuck away from one another of her father's boring club parties. I'm different now. In the light of the half-moon, she could just make out Flick's sharp features when she snuck a glance. I think I know what you mean. Moving here, I've changed, too. I don't do the things I used to. You know, the things that kind of define me. What kind of things? All she really knew was that he'd come from New York and had a stepfather with a lot of money who drove her parents crazy. But she had a sense Flick was different. I don't know, little things, like how I used to ride the subway. The New York subway system defined you? She meant it as a joke, but as the words stumbled from her mouth, she heard a judgment in them. Even in the shadows, she could see his expression harden. Never mind, it sounds stupid. No, it doesn't, she shifted uncomfortably on the seat. I'm sorry, that came out kind of harsh. Foot turned to her. Yeah, it did. At least he didn't seem mad. Darcy smiled inwardly. She liked that he was so direct. Direct was refreshing. All the guys she knew said one thing but meant another. Please, tell me more about New York. It wasn't the subway. It was the freedom I had. I missed the energy, the stadiums, the people, the food. There was so much to do. Have you had to drive everywhere? And let's be honest, it's just fields and trees. Darcy couldn't argue with that, any of that. You must be so bored. Pretty much. Why'd you guys move here if you love the city? My mom got married and then Stan, my stepfather, retired. He decided we should move up here. It was all kind of fast. This was interesting. Do you like your stepdad? When Flick shrugged, his shoulders brushed against hers. I don't dislike him. So that's a no. They both laughed. He's okay. He's got a different outlook, let's say. Stan made a lot of money, and he kind of shows it off. I think he wants us to. Yeah, I saw the Ferrari in your driveway. Hard to miss that orange. Don't forget about the RV. I know your father loves that. Darcy had to laugh. Her parents were so worked up about what to do about it. And yet here, she and Flick were talking openly. Adults made so many things complicated. Still, it must be nice having money. God, I would kill for a car like that. First of all, I don't drive the Ferrari, though I would like to, he admitted. But having all that stuff is weird. It's Stan's stuff, not mine. I get that, Darcy allowed. So you didn't live like this before, it sounds. She hoped that didn't offend him. God knew her nosiness got her in trouble sometimes. No, my mom and I never lived like this. We had a small apartment, and the Chevy I drive now, that was it. His voice grew soft. We didn't have a lot, but we had what we needed. His admission was so honest, Darcy felt the urge to reach for his hand. It was right there, resting on the cart, seat next to her. But she didn't want to give him the wrong idea. I know what you mean, she said, instead. When she'd seen Flick walking out of the clubhouse earlier, all she wanted to do was get the hell out of the party. She would have left with almost anyone. Now she was glad to be here with him. Thanks for helping me escape, she told him. Club dinner parties are so lame. Listening to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Joanne, and thanks for listening.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Are you a Worcester Regional Transit Authority paratransit rider from Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northborough, Oxford, Westboro, or West Boylston? Did you know that you no longer have to call customer service to book your trips? You can now take advantage of our new online reservation system and book your trips online at any time. Call customer service at 508-791-9782. Or email paratransit@therta.com to set up your online account to begin scheduling your trips. Please note the online reservation system is an additional option for your convenience. You can still call customer service to book your trips.